Welcome to Raw Book Pod, inclusively yours. This week, I decided to focus on Black romance and how it's being upheld in history, because it's also Black History Month. So today I have with me Steve Amidale from Brown Pop Culture Library. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you, Dan?
I'm great. How are you?
Good, thanks. Good.
So you're from Brown Pop Culture Library. Can you just give us an idea of what your job is there and how you guys preserve all pop culture at your library?
Sure. So the Brown Popular Culture Library at Bowling Green State University was established in 1969. We are the oldest repository for popular culture in an academic setting. So that what does that mean? That means we are trying to preserve everything that people use as entertainment or that amuses them on a daily basis. So the idea was to create a place where things like popular fiction, comic books, toys, movies, radio, posters, all of that stuff could kind of be in one place as a research library. So we're here for researchers. We're also here for the public. We're a public institution for the public good. So we're here for anybody who wants to come in, whether they're local or they want to come visit. We're happy to share our collections and talk for hours on end about all the things that we love in pop culture.
Right. I can't remember how I first started following the library, but I know one day you guys had a post and it was like old buttons, like the pins.
Yeah.
And like I have old buttons, like I think I have an old Dare button that I got from elementary school. And I'm like, oh my gosh, these look just as old as mine. I have like a couple other ones, like I'm kind of like creating an enamel pin collection. So I just was so fascinated with, I'm like, oh, they have all these pins. I love these.
Yeah. So pinback buttons became a thing in the 60s, really, where they all of a sudden became really cheap to make. And people got into, you know, putting them on jackets or putting them on bags or whatever. And, you know, it so happened that was around the time when we started. So we have this collection really going back 50 years of political buttons, pop culture buttons. We have Pizza Hut Book It buttons. You know, we've got a little bit of everything. It's really kind of fun. And so the buttons are generally sitting in boxes. And one day I was sitting around thinking about it. I was like, these are too cool. And so I started doing a thing called Today's Button on our Twitter account, where every day we post a different button and, you know, try to give it some context, like this is what this is all about, or we just try to have fun with it. But yeah, the button collection is just fantastic. There's just so much cool stuff in there.
Yes. And like how this relates to romance, like when I first started going to book, like romance book events, like signings in 2014, like that was like one of the biggest swag things was like mm-hmm. buttons. So like I had a big, I literally had to get rid of them because it was just too much. I had so many buttons from uh-huh. like all these different authors. One when I went to RT, I think it was the RT that was in Vegas, an author had a thing where she had a sash. And it was like a contest. You could win something. And she was like, go to all these different authors and get their button and put it on the sash and then do an Instagram photo and you'll be entered in this contest to win. I think it was like a Kindle or iPad or something. It was something really nice.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have like so, I had so many. I'm like, I just need, like the last con I went to, I think the RWA conference in New York, that was the last one I went to. Okay. I was like, when I go here, I'm not going to pick up any buttons because like I don't need any more. Like I had to like tell myself, do not pick up any more pins. Like don't,
yeah.
Like just don't. But yeah, I love them. They're so cool and I love to put them on my shirt. I have like on my backpack, I have Avon had a pin that it says something about diverse romance. I can't remember exactly what it says, but okay. I think I got it. I think Alicia Rye, she had one that was like that. And Mia Sosa, she also had one. I think I got it from them when I went to a festival. But I'm just like, I need to fall back on the pins.
I do that all the time because, you know, it's part of my job is this collecting aspect. And so I'll show up somewhere. I'm like, ooh, there's a button. Oh, there's a button, you know. And then I leave them at work, which is kind of fun. And the same goes with books and things. I'll just like, oh, this should be in the collection. You know?
It's so weird. So you guys are having a conference in, I want to say, April?
Yeah. So we are doing a romance conference called Researching the Romance, Romance Across Boundaries. And the dates are April 22nd to 23rd. And it's going to be here in Bowling Green. We have a really great lineup of presenters, from people who are in academia, people who are authors, people who are just fans, kind of across the spectrum. And then our guest of honor is going to be Alyssa Cole. So we're really excited to have her come visit us here and hang out. And it should be a lot of fun. This is the second time that I've done this. We did one back in 2018, and Beverly Jenkins was our guest of honor for that. So this is, we're continuing a long tradition. The very first romance conference we had was back in 1997, and it was one of the first times romance had kind of had that academic conference at a university. And it was to sort of mark our entrance into a partnership with romance authors and with RWA to start archiving manuscripts and personal papers and all kinds of things.
Oh, that's great. It's funny as you mentioned 1997, because like at that time I was still young, spring in my prime, you know. But I was reading at that time, but I wasn't reading romance. And like one of the main reasons I wasn't reading romance is because when I would see a romance book, I would see like these ones with like these like the historical ones, and I would just look at it and it was like, that's not for me, like, you know, not to be ageist, but when I would look at those books, I'm like, those books are for old people. Sure. Like,
yeah.
Like nothing about that book said it was for an 18-year-old girl. And I think I was always looking for romance, but when I would go in the bookstore to find, like, all the Black books were in the African American section. Right. So like when I picked up a book, there was no way for me to know if it was a romance or not. I would have to like sift through every book to find out which one was a romance. So right. I would just pick up one to see like if the blurb interested me. It might be a romance, it might not be, but I was kind of just like, oh, let me see, like, oh, this is a lady's name, let me look at this book. Or
right.
Oh, I recognize this name, let me look at this book. But I never could really find exactly what I wanted because it was kind of like a hodgepodge of every genre, but mm-hmm. the author is Black. So, like, I never right. went into the romance section because I just was like, I'm not going to find any books with Black people on them in this section. So I have to just kind of, like, fend for myself. Like, you know, it's kind of like a Burlington type store.
Yeah.
Like, where the clothes are not, like, you just know, like, everything in here is a large, but you don't right. know what type of shirt it is, you know, so you have to sift through it to find yeah. exactly what you're looking for. And sometimes I'm like, I don't feel like looking through all these books to find something. So that kind of, like, turned me off from reading fine books like that, because I'm like, unless mm-hmm. I, like, will read a magazine and, like, sometimes in, like Black hair style books or Essence or mm-hmm. Ebony, they might have a book mentioned. So I'm like, oh, let me pick this up. But if it wasn't like something explicitly telling me this is a romance, then I'm just like, I don't know what it is. I'm just going to read whatever I pick up. First book I pick up.
And that makes sense, because 95 was when Arabesque debuted. And even then, those early Arabesque books weren't really clearly marked. There was just, you knew there was a couple on the cover, you know, in some sort of embrace. That was your only real clue, because they didn't like say Arabesque on them. They said Pinnacle or Kensington or something like that. And that was kind of you were looking like only 2 years into the explosion of Black romance. It really hadn't taken off yet in any meaningful way.
That's like part of my thing for this year. I was like, let me go back and read some of these earlier Black romances. Like one I saw, someone had talked about it on Twitter, I believe. And it was mm-hmm. Adam and Eva, I believe, by Sandra Kitt.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I was like, let me pick this up. And I didn't really know like what the conventions of romance were.
Yeah. And Sandra Kidd is a great example. I mean, she's someone, she was the first Black writer to write for Harlequin, and then the first Black writer to write Black characters for Harlequin as well, with Adam and Eva. That was really the first Harlequin book, at least. And then, you know, she goes on, she, you know, is one of the first authors for Arabesque in 95. And then also in 95, she writes The Color of Love, which is one of the first interracial romance novels. You know, so she's someone who's definitely like a kind of keystone author in all of this. She's been around the whole time.
And also when I follow you guys on Twitter, it's funny to me because like whenever stuff flares up in romance landia, as they say, I see you guys post a lot of romance stuff. And it's sometimes like when I get into the history of it, it kind of calms me down because I can like divert my attention like, oh, let me look into this, you know, something to keep my mind off of the burning fires in the background. So I saw you guys recently, you posted a picture of the first RWA board, and it had Vivian, I believe it was about 8 people, and yes. You guys also posted a copy of the first, what do they call them? Like the minutes of the first meeting.
Right, you know, the meeting and minutes,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, and that was like so interesting. I'm like, I don't know, I might have to like just drive to where you guys are located and just like, you know, because I'm like a minor, what I call a minor history buff. Like,
sure. Yeah.
That's why like I have to have like when I read, I can't read on like a Kindle Voyager or something. I need a tablet because if something interesting comes up in a book, I'm like, oh, let me research this. And then I've left the book alone and I've done researched one little tiny tidbit in a book that I saw.
And the romance history stuff to me is fascinating because a lot of it has never really been compiled in one place, right? Like there, you know, there's a few books here and there, but like a lot of it is just sort of scattered around, and it's, you know, in an old Romantic Times magazine or an old Romance Writers Report, or buried in, you know, the files of RWA. Right. So, you know, when stuff like that comes up, I, you know, I have the same thing where I'm like, I want to go look at this. I know I've seen this before, or this has happened before. You know, and what happened that time, and sometimes it's entirely unintentional. You know, like posting that picture of the first RWA board was, I was literally, you know, doing research for somebody else, and I saw that, and I was like, oh, that's really cool. And then I, you know, we posted it, and I was kind of like, that may have carried more meaning than I thought it would. So,
right. Yeah, I've read how you said there's not a lot of history about romance. I found this, I was just googling something and this book came up. I'm pretty sure you've heard of it. Publishing Romance: The History of an Industry 1940s to Present by John Markert.
Yes.
And it was weird because I'm like, this book was published in 2016, so like when I was reading through it and I was seeing like the publishers that they mentioned, and I'm like, uh-oh, like they had some stuff going on. And then I'm like, because they had like Allura's Cave, they were the first to do like, I'm like, uh-oh. And then like they had something about Dream Spinner, and I'm like,
I think Sam Hain is in there as well.
I actually do an updated version.
I have that book right here, actually. It's sitting right next to me. Because I was just doing some background research on Vivian Stevens, and she got interviewed a lot by John Markert for that book and some other projects that he worked on. It's a really interesting book. It's very business oriented.
Yes.
It doesn't go a lot into like what fan response was, you know, like why people were buying books and things like that. So it's, you know, it's kind of a partial history. Like I think it's really interesting for what it is, and it's really helpful because a lot of those dates, you know, don't get written down, or they get obscured, or someone forgot, or whatever. So yeah, that's a really good one. There's another book called The Merchants of Venus by Paul Gresko, and that is a history of Harlequin. And that was written, when was that written? 1996. So even that is like, is hysterically out of date. It's almost, you know, it's 20 plus years old. So yeah, like that's the thing is, you know, these books get published and then they're out of date, you know, almost as soon as they hit the shelf.
Right. It's time for a new updated version, especially, you know, like something for the, because even like I think when this book was written, I was looking and it was saying how reluctant RWA was to have like digital imprints within them, and like now it's like totally digital. Like if you aren't digital, it's like people aren't even really paying attention. And then like also with the increase of audio listening, you know, how that's changed romance so much. It really needs somebody to, if I was a historian, if I knew how, not even if I knew how to write, if I liked writing, I would write the book. But I don't even like writing.
Yeah.
I like reading. I don't like writing.
And I think, you know, in this day and age, it's important that we have, you know, there's writers like Kelly Faircloth at Jezebel who are fans of the genre, who are writing about the genre. You know, I think that's really important because, you know, as we've seen a million times, like when you don't understand it, it's hard for you to write about it in a way that's not going to really tick people off.
Right. So. Not mockingly.
Exactly.
As someone did not so long ago.
Well, like 6 days or six months. I don't remember anymore.
And we're going to have the influx of them in February. It's just, ugh.
Oh, yeah. And you know, thanks to recent events, we've already seen it where it's started to churn and you're like, oh, not another one.
So. Yeah. Something you mentioned is you said that it's a lot of that book is a lot of like market centered and not really reader centered. Uh-huh. And something I read in the book, it had a part where Vivian Stevens, she said she went into a Woolworths to see what books people were picking up. And she spoke to someone and she said, you know, oh, I bought this book for my, you know, just to have. She's like, I'm not going to read it right now, but I bought it just to have it when I'm in the mood to read it. Yeah. And that resonated with me so much because I'm such a mood reader. Like, I'll buy books and I'm like, I don't want to read it right now. I have to be in the mood to read it. I'm like, that just resonated with me so much, the mood reader thing. I'm like, because that's totally me. And I do think we also need the reader side of it, because if you're just thinking about, like, especially back then, because it was different. I think now a lot of the metrics to judge what people like is so much reviews. You know, it's not even really like purchases. It's like, get the reviews in. So it's, I wonder, like, how did they measure what was good back then? Did they just go based off purchases and that was it, or did they listen to reviews? But even if they did, how did they learn about reviews? Because it wasn't like a place where you could just write a review for a book. It was like, I guess you wrote the magazine or something. I don't even know how they would tell someone about a review.
And the thing about, like, you know, 1979, 1980 is that one of the things that Vivian really pioneered was that aspect of user research, like going out and actually talking to people who read the books. Because before that, the publishers were just like you said, you know, this sold 5,000 copies, we should make another one. And, you know, they weren't really talking about, you know, women like to buy these books and hold on to them, or they, you know, they don't like books with too much cleavage on the cover or whatever. Like, they weren't really looking at that. And Vivian was definitely one of the pioneers of that idea. And it was partially because she wasn't a romance reader by her nature.
Right.
You know, she wasn't an editor. She came from, she was a researcher at Time Life and kind of happened into this job at Candlelight. And she was like, well, I need to go learn about my craft. And, you know, she went out and actually learned and was able to come up with some really groundbreaking ideas because of it.
And I also read, like, how she was, when she came out with the Candlelight Ecstasy line, like, that was, like, the move to more sensual stuff. Like, I can't even, like, probably because, like, I was little at that time. So, like, in my prime of reading, like, it was, like, already, like, super explicit. So I'm like, yeah, what would be sensual in the 80s? And not only that, I've seen a couple of these 80s movies, and they were showing a little stuff. They were showing some things.
Yeah.
So I'm like, what would be considered, like, she said it was sensual but not explicit. So I'm like, what would that even be at that time? It's a lot of times it's hard when you look back because you're used to a certain picture in your mind, so you can't think of what it would be back in a different time, you know?
Yeah.
Unless you lived in that time.
Exactly. And I think at that point, it's important to distinguish between, like, two different kinds of romance. There was, like, the big, thick Avon books that were, like, you know, Kathleen Woody-Wiss, Rosemary Rogers, like, those, the historicals, that were as explicit as you could make a book at that point when it came to sex. And then you had Harlequin on the other end, where their, like, little category books were, there would be a kiss at the end, and that was it. And so Vivian was kind of, like, in the middle space, where it was, like, there'd be a lot of colorful language, and, you know, there would be a lot of indications that something was going on, or something had just happened, you know, and that was candlelight ecstasy, sort of moving towards not quite in the bedroom, but at least, like, leaving the bedroom door open kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there were really, like, two different tracks. Like, you had the books that, you know, there would be rape scenes. There was a lot of everything in them. And then you had these very sort of sweet isn't the right word, but that's the one that everyone uses, you know, that were just young girls having their first kiss kind of thing.
Also, in this book, they talk about how they say the first, which when I read this, I said it didn't surprise me, because they said the first African-American line of romances from a major publishing house was launched by Kensington Press in 1994. And when you look at the Rip Bodice's diversity report, Kensington has the largest amount of black authors.
Yeah. So it, like, always has been.
I was not surprised when I read that. I was like, figures, you know.
Yeah.
I was like, I figured that they would have the largest amount.
And, yeah, absolutely.
I think back on this time, I'm like, I think I did read a lot of Kensington books at this time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and sometimes I can remember, like, what a book was about, but I cannot remember the author. I cannot remember the name of the book. I need somewhere. And it's hard because I know, like, they have, like, I think Smart Bitches does, where you can tell them, like, parts of a book and they can kind of tell you but I'm like, I need this, but for black people. I'm like, because I'm pretty sure you guys didn't read any of these books that I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
You talked about Arabesque, and mm-hmm. Kensington said they sold the Arabesque line to BET, and they had BET books. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's where I got a lot of my, because at that time, I wasn't really reading a lot of books, but I was super into magazines. So, like, I would always get, like, the hairstyle books, or I would get Essence and Ebony. So, like, I remember, and because when I was thinking about, I was like, how did I find these books that I would read? Like, did I just go in the library or go in? But then when I thought about it, I'm like, oh, I would see it advertised in a magazine, and then I would go and get the book. Or, like, another thing they used to have was they had a double day book club, like, where you, like, it was like Columbia House, where you mail them in. And, like, you would get it in a magazine, and it would be like, oh, you can get these two books for a penny. You know, just put the stamp on it and mail it in. And then I would never pay for the books, and then I would have to use a fake name, but the same address. And I would get books like that, and then sometimes, you know, inside the book, it might be like, look for our next book coming out such and such date, you know?
Right.
So, but yeah, that's like, it was kind of, like, different rather than now, how we just, like, now I literally get all my recs from social media or my local library. When I go in my library, they have a whole wall.
Right.
And I live in Baltimore County. And,
okay,
We have a pretty large population of black people. So they get a lot of black books. Like, they really have a lot of them. I never really have a problem finding them when I go in the library, because they're, like, right there. They shelve them well. But it may be harder for people in smaller areas where they're not as easily found. But
yeah. Well, and just to go back to Kensington for a second, you know, Walt Zacharias, who's the guy who started Kensington, was really experimental, especially in the 90s. You know, in addition to Arabesque, he had Encanto, which was a line that was originally, it was Latinx authors and characters, and it always came in an English and a Spanish dual translated edition. So, like, they experimented with that for a while. They had a line that was older main characters. So it wasn't just 19, 25-year-olds. You know, it was people in their 40s and 50s. You know, he kind of went out there, and he hired people of color, and he hired women who were interested in kind of pushing the boundaries of romance. So I think, you know, they deserve a lot of credit. I mean, their number in the Rip Bodice report is, I think, 22%, which is not perfect, but it's a lot better, like you said.
Right, right. I think it's relative to, I guess, the population of Black people in America.
Sure.
It's kind of like around that sweet spot, but like other people can do better.
Right, right.
As we say, you can do better, you know.
Exactly. But,
yeah. And it's weird because coming into romance, I come from indie. I started reading YA. And when I was reading YA, a lot of YA, you know, people talk about it, but a lot of these YA books are basically romance. You know, right. It's a sci-fi or dystopian, but it's a romance. I mean, Hunger Games had a romance in it.
Right, yeah.
You know, so a lot of these books are romances, and I think when I was reading YA, I realized, you know, I wanted something more contemporary and more focused on the romance than some of the other stuff, and so I had started reading indie, and so even with reading Black romance, I read a lot more indie than I read published, so, like, a lot of these numbers didn't really surprise me, because I'm like, the only people I knew that did romance, I knew Kamani. Like, I didn't know anything else. Because when I go into my local store, if I go into Walmart, everything there was Kamani. Like, as far as the romance books.
Yeah, and now even that's gone, so.
Right, you know, and I had mentioned this because my local Walmart, they had all the Kamani books. But since Kamani's gone, I don't see any Black romance at all. Even, like, some of the Kamani authors who started writing for Harlequin Desires. I see Harlequin Desires books there, but I don't see the ones by the Black authors.
Yeah.
So that void, it really took a lot from, you know, what people can see in the stores. And yeah, that really sold to me. I felt like it sold well, because I would always see people over in that area, you know, Black readers in that area looking for those books. So that's a big loss.
Yeah, absolutely.
With your commitment to diversity. And yes, that is shade. Okay, Steve. So I wanted to ask, what could Black romance authors do to help preserve our literature in your library? You know, what kind of things do you accept, or, you know, do you like to see from people submitting or in your library?
Sure. So, you know, I always start from saving your own stuff, you know, saving stuff for, you know, your descendants, for your kids, for, you know, people to sort of show that you did a thing, that you were part of this community. So, you know, saving things like manuscripts, print copies, sometimes drafts can be really helpful. I know that it's a little harder in digital form than it was way back when Gwyn Forrester, who's an author back in the 90s, like, did all of her books in longhand first in notebooks. And so, you know, we have her notebooks and then her typed drafts and then the final ones. But anything that shows the process, what I always talk about is this idea of process, product, and response. So collecting, you know, the things that show how the book got made, how the thing you created got made. And then the product itself, so the book, you know, the audiobooks, the translated versions, whatever. And then the response being, you know, swag that gets created or reviews or things like that that show how readers reacted to the book, you know, because those are the things that researchers want to see. They want to be able to track careers across time, and they want to see different aspects of the creation and the life of a novel. So those are the things we like to see. It really varies depending on the person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone like, you know, a Sandra Kitt, you know, we want to see her whole career, you know, to be able to show how impactful she was. For some authors who maybe only wrote one book, you know, we just want to be able to show that that book existed. So that's really it. It kind of depends. We're always happy to talk to people to see, you know, if what you have is stuff that we can collect. You know, we can't collect right now a lot of digital stuff. We collect mostly paper and things like that. You know, and we're also always happy to accept monetary donations to help us preserve more of this history. You know, these things, especially at a public university, these things don't come cheap. You know, we have to kind of depend on everyone else's kindness a lot of times. So, yeah, so it really depends. And, you know, we're happy to have people come to our website and see what we have and talk to us about how we can help you.
Yes, I love that. I'm a minor history buff.
Uh-huh.
But I just love seeing stuff like how you said, from creation to how it is now. Like, I'm very much that type of person. Like, I'll watch, it's a show called How It's Made, and they'll show they make stuff. Yeah. But I'm like, okay, but how did they make the machine that made that stuff?
Sure, yeah.
Like, I need to know, like, it was an idea, and then we decided to make this machine. Okay, make the machine, and then, you know. So it's all very interesting, and I'm definitely going to have to, if I can't make it to the conference, I'm going to have to do a road trip or something. I definitely need to go out there, and because I'm also, like, a very just pop culture of different stuff. Like, I have... Sure. I have a big book collection, but
uh-huh.
I know I'm going to get some heat for this. Don't hate me. I got rid of some of my books to make room for my Funko collection. I can't help it.
I don't blame you one bit.
I had to. I'm like a Funko fanatic. It's taking over my house. So, like, I'm very into, like, and, like, everything that I collect that's Funko is stuff that, like, I liked back when I was younger. I'm like, oh, I need all these Hanna-Barbera Funkos because I used to love those shows.
And that's, like, and that's what you should collect. You should collect right. The stuff that you like and that means something to you, not because, oh, this might be valuable in 15 years
yes,
or whatever.
That's, like, my biggest pet peeve is, like, a lot of the Funko collectors are like, oh, I need something that's going to be worth such and such in this. I'm like, no, I just collect the stuff that I like.
Right.
Especially stuff that I liked when I was a kid. So I'm like so into that stuff. And then, like how I said, I also have, like, my enamel pin collection. My son is, like, really into video games, and I'm, like, also into it too. So, like,
mm-hmm.
I have some of those, and I'm like a super a cartoon that's, like, it's like romance novels, cartoons, you know.
Uh-huh.
I have, like, my little things that I like. So, like, my other thing is cartoons, and I have, like, enamel pins from, like, animes or, like, other little cartoon shows that come on. I might have to send you all my Barbies, because I'm like, I don't know what I'm gonna do with these Barbies because I don't have any daughters. I have a son.
Yeah,
I need, like, a huge house for everything I need to collect. I need a huge library, a huge place for all my Funkos, a place for my Barbies, a place for my enamel pins.
Well,
like, I can have my own pop culture library just in my house.
and I'll say, like, we do occasionally say, okay, we have enough of this. And we'll get rid of some stuff just because, you know, we're one floor of a library where, you know, we only have so many square feet. And with a research collection, the more you narrow it down, the more useful it is.
Right, right.
Right, like, otherwise you're just like, I'm just swamped with Funkos.
Right,
you know,
right.
I need to, like, get down to, like, the 10 that were popular or whatever.
Right, right, the super popular ones, the ones that were, like, the holy grail ones.
Exactly.
Like you said, otherwise it'd just be like, what is this?
Yeah, yeah.
It was great talking to you, Steve. It really
Thanks.
Was.
I really enjoyed this, and I really appreciate you giving me the time.
And tell everyone your website and your Twitter for your library.
Our Twitter handle is at @BGSU_popcultlib. Or you can just look us up as the Brown with an E Popular Culture Library. You should see a picture of Captain Kirk standing in front of some romance novels. And then our website is bgsu.edu/library/PCL.
Okay, and again, your conference, and just to let everybody know, two of our Round Book Pod co-hosts, Melinda, she's going to have something there on mental health rep and romance, and Sarah Jean is going to be presenting on Avon's history of gay pulp fiction and romance and how it relates to romance today. And when's that conference again?
Sure. So it is April 22nd to 23rd of 2020. And to find out more, you can go to scholarworks.bgsu.edu/researchingromance. Or you can just look up Researching the Romance BGSU.
Okay. So thanks everyone for listening. And I hope you tune in next time for more inclusive romance.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Rom Book Pod, Inclusively Yours, a new weekly podcast celebrating inclusive romance, one trope at a time. If you like weekly recs for inclusive romance, please take a moment to subscribe. You can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest at Rom Book Pod. That's ROMBKPOD. Thank you for joining us, and until next time, happy reading.